Москва ответит взаимностью Евросоюз, который сегодня...
Европа поражена русофобией.
Кто должен быть главным партнером России? Европейский
Союз? Путь домой. Украина, Грузия.
И у России, и у Молдовы общая история, общие ценности.
Russia's conflict with Europe is not going away anytime soon. The Kremlin will continue to seek domestic legitimacy and pursue great power ambitions with diversionary wars. In Ukraine, Georgia, and Moldova will remain in Moscow's crosshairs. These were some of the conclusions of a widely discussed new report by Andrew Wilson and Frederick Weslau of the European Council on Foreign Relations titled Russia 2030, a story of great power dreams and small victorious wars. So welcome to the new normal. Hello from our broadcast headquarters in Prague, and welcome to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from London is Mark Galeotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Welcome, Mark.
Hey there, good to be here.
And also joining us from London is Andrew Wilson, a senior policy fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, co-author of the report we'll be discussing today, and author of the recently published book, The Ukraine Crisis, What It Means for the West. Welcome back, Andrew.
Good to be here.
Good to have you. So, Andrew, in the report, you and Frederick identified five kind of trends. Russia's domestic rut continues and the Kremlin continues to rely on small diversionary wars for legitimacy. Russia increasingly relies on force. Russia continues to target its neighbors. Georgia, Ukraine, and Moldova continue to muddle through in reform. And Belarus, Azerbaijan, and Armenia remain stuck in security limbo. Sounds like more of the same. So the upshot is that that's it. It's more of the same for the foreseeable future, no?
Yeah, which is a pretty boring prediction. even if it lasts for 14 years, because the report is actually called Russia and the Neighborhood in 2030. I mean, it's not really an exercise in predicting exactly what will happen over those 14 years. It's more a point of looking at important assumptions, key trends, and what kind of inflection points or changes might come along to disrupt those trends. So that's a more important question.
Well, let's pick up on that. What are some of the things in the report that you say could reverse the trends?
Well, we'll have to try and define the trends first, I guess.
Yeah, let's go from the start. I mean, I guess we got, Russia's domestic rut continues and the Kremlin continues to rely on small diversionary wars. What could reverse that?
Well, the key assumption is that every state needs legitimacy. That Russia isn't either a normal democracy or even a normal autocracy. If you're a normal democracy, you've got legitimacy for however long your term of office is. Our British Prime Minister has 5 years. He's only had one. Some people are calling him to go because he's made a mess of the referendum. That's kind of breaking the rules of democracy. He's safe for however long he wants to sit. But Russia isn't a normal autocracy either. It needs these kind of Putin super ratings to keep the system ticking over. 80 or 90% rather than just 50 or 60. And we argue that without a social contract, without the economy doing as well as it did in Putin's first two terms, then the new normal is diversionary conflict. And we also say that it has to be medium-level diversionary conflict, big enough to make a difference, but not so risky as to burn resources or to... trip over into higher level conflicts that Russia doesn't actually want and certainly can't afford. So a cycle of kind of diversionary conflict is the way to keep legitimacy ticking over unless some other means can be found. I mean, that could be an answer to your first question. You know, what inflection points might come along? It could be economic recovery, though one thing we point out in the report is that in 2008, the summer of 2008, when Russia went to war in Georgia. Russia's economy was doing well. The oil price was actually quite high. So economic recovery could actually cut either way. It could provide an alternative source of legitimacy, or it could provide the resources to be more aggressive. We also talked about the Eastern Neighborhood States as actors as well as objects. You know, what they do affects what is possible for Russia. medium-level conflict we predict is the cycle for the foreseeable future.
Now, you also talk about the potential of economic collapse, and would that maybe stop this cycle because the money simply wouldn't be there?
Well, again, it could cut either way, just as economic recovery might. It might force the government to think about bringing people like Kudrin back closer to the center of power, doing some things to avert economic collapse, or it could increase the incentives for diversionary behaviors. It all depends what type of economic collapse, how quick it is, what economic response options Russia has, what diversionary options Russia has.
Mark, what were your big takeaways here? What jumped out at you in this report?
Well, I think, again, it's interesting that in some ways, although it's titled Russia 2030, in some ways it is actually about perceptions of Russia 2016, as is inevitably the case. And I mean, obviously, sort of Frederick and Andrew are wise enough in the ways of the world, but especially this bit of the world, to know that actually any attempt to try and predict what's going to happen over 14 years is always going to be an exercise in speculation rather than certainty. The thing that struck me is, I was on the one hand, and I should actually sort of parenthetically note, by the way, that this is terribly unfair to Andrew, because as I told Frederick, since I'm currently a visiting fellow at the ECFR, almost I'm honour-bound to put the boot in slightly just to demonstrate my independence of opinion. very compelling case made about the sort of the economic plight, the economic dimension, that obviously links in with the demographic dimension, that there's going to be 5 million fewer Russians by 2030 at the current rate. And it's very hard to really argue with the general sort of take on both the state of the neighborhood going forward, but also Russia's relationship with it. The one area that I would want to actually take issue, which, as I said, I think says more about current perceptions than anything else, is this notion of legitimation by warfare. In the sense that I'm actually not convinced that there is currently an attempt to legitimate through conflict. The Donbass, after all, was essentially a secret war. Syria isn't secret in broad terms, but actually in detail is. I mean, they're using mercenaries to try and conceal the level to which actually Russian soldiers are fighting and dying. And there's actually very little evidence, in my opinion, that anyway this has particular resonance with the Russian people. So in some ways, for me, the big takeaway was that actually there's not a lot that can be done with the economy so long as Putin, and all this, by the way, has one crucial underlying point. This is so long as Putin is in the Kremlin, which he could conceivably be at 78.
He will be 78 in 2030.
But you might say, so let's sort of, this is all assuming Putin is in the Kremlin, that I see no evidence that there can be any substantive economic reform which will turn around the broad dynamic. They can make it worse, they can make it a little bit better, but broadly speaking, they'll continue in decline. Same for the demographics, same, frankly, for the overall relationship with Russia's neighbours. It's really this whole question of how do you find legitimacy in a time of increasing economic and thus social tension, and also, therefore, probably intra-elite tension. Now, this report posits one particular model, which is the use of conflict. And again, give it its due, there is a little note that conflict doesn't actually necessarily mean war. And I think one could extend that to more of a sort of fortress Russia, building a sense of being at war, even if you're not actually at war. But I think this is really, for me, the key question, the different ways in which actually a Putin regime could seek to legitimize itself now that the bad times are upon them.
Andrew, what about that? Are we overestimating the degree to which, because I share your assumptions on this, I do believe that Putin is pursuing legitimacy through these small diversionary wars. Are we over? Is there a chance we are overestimating this?
Well, to rephrase Mark's basic point, it's worth asking whether this actually works, because it doesn't always work. We're sort of
if you look at Putin's numbers, if you look at Putin's numbers, it seems to be working, though.
Well, the thing that had the biggest impact on his poll ratings was obviously Crimea, whereas the current conflicts or pseudo-conflicts with Syria Turkey, you know, haven't shifted the numbers very much, partly because they were up high already, and the kind of last 10% is impossible to get.
And the failure in Donbass didn't knock them down.
It did a little, yeah, and so they've gone back up a little, but probably not by as much as this model ought to predict. So another way of looking at the dates is to go back 20 years, right, rather than forward 40. All of this comes from the kind of 20-year cycle of political technology that you've had since 1996, which was when Yeltsin first triumphed against the semi-mythical communist threat. So Russia's been doing this for a long time, which is why I think they'll continue to do so. In some ways, they're skilled at it. In some ways, they know when it's not working and they have to shift. But it is noticeable that, not for reasons of secrecy, I don't think, so much as the fact that the conflict with Turkey was somehow inexplicable, certainly against elite interests and the interests of ordinary Russians who'd like to go to Turkey on holiday and gas transit or whatever. It did seem a very strange country to pick an argument with. Syria, I think, had some traction in terms of narrative. Russia was doing things better than America did. It was doing it more cheaply. It wasn't going to get bogged down like America in the conflict, although it hasn't withdrawn as successfully as it promised to. So I see some traction there, but a limited impact on public opinion. So there is a question of, you know, how successful this kind of thing is and whether it does provide you that kind of extra shot in the arm that I think the system regularly requires. So you have to find some other way of doing it. One possibility, though, is to scale it down a bit, to go back to domestic affairs. I don't think there's a necessary cycle of escalation at all.
I mean, one of the things that keeps jumping out at me as I read things like this, and this relationship between economics and foreign affairs and legitimacy, is I can't help but think that Putin is repeating the mistakes of Brezhnev's Soviet Union and not understanding the very intimate connection between great power status and a sound, resilient, strong economy. And do you get that sense as well, that history, in a sense, is repeating itself here?
Well, history never repeats itself exactly.
No, but it rhymes.
It's certainly true that a lot of what Russia is doing at the moment is predicated on the defense build-up of the Serdyukov years, paid for by a recovered oil price. And there's a kind of inbuilt advantage still there. But even in military terms, the kind of build-up of material and arms isn't going to be completed to the extent that it was supposed to be. So Russia has a relative advantage over its neighbors, but not over bigger rivals. So even in military terms, with the military taking more than its fair share of resources, there are clear constraints, which is one reason why we said the system needs to pick on easy targets, because it doesn't have the resources for conflicts that are too protracted or too real.
Right. Mark,
which is a lesson from East Ukraine, I think.
Right. Mark, you watch militaries for a living. I mean, when do we hit this tipping point? When does the economics make the military adventurism no longer possible, or does it?
Well, in theory, I suppose a state like Putin's has still a great capacity to focus resources. But to be perfectly honest, one could even make the case that actually the tipping point has been reached. As well as downloading and reading this report, which, I mean, as I said, is actually an excellent report, even if I sort of cavil about some of the issues. Let me also direct people to the website of the Swedish Institute for International Affairs, where, and it's not for my bit, but I recently gave a sort of a joint event with Sasha Goltz, who is, for my money, you know, one of the best observers of the Russian military, you know, particularly a Russian. And then if people sort of therefore fast forward my blurb to his bit and hear what he has to say about the Russian military, I mean, he paints a very, very gloomy picture of a military that yes, has had made some strides, but if anything, it's already in the process of sliding back, in part because of economic reasons, in part because of demographic reasons, but also in part because of political decisions, like this current thing about we're going to be building up new divisions on our border with Europe, and that'll show you for not being nice to us and so forth, which are actually clawing back a certain amount of the ground that had been made under Serdyukov and in the early Shoigu years. So, I mean, the interesting thing is there's already a sort of a deployment of force in into Syria, which is frankly stuck. Unless they're willing to make either expect to have some kind of grand breakthrough, which I don't think is going to happen, or are willing to actually pay the political costs of pulling back. There's a deployment of force into Donbass, and the need to maintain a certain reserve of force, because the point is the actual Russian regular troops, their use is historically has been when the Ukrainian army looks as if it's going to make a breakthrough. That's when they surge the battalion tactical groups in and so forth. So they need to have those forces ready and waiting just in case. They're really running surprisingly low of mobilizable field forces, and actually they're going to have a problem keeping the current size of the force in the future with the shrinking population, let alone actually sort of expansion so that they can continue other ones. So, I mean, I think this is the sort of the great problem. What Putin needs are not wars that are actual and real, but that are virtual. Mm-hmm. And this is where I think I would sort of, let's say, reach a similarish conclusion to the Russia 2030 report, but through a different route. You know, not so much actually seeing genuine kinetic operations, because they are problematic and actually very expensive, not just in terms of the soldiers, but everything else, let alone more sanctions or whatever. But actually trying to manufacture the hullabaloo, the sound and the fury and the glory of warfare without actually anything happening. Because if one looks at the actual places where Putin could intervene, actually he's running out of, or maybe even has run out of, easy targets. Things that might actually bring some kind of payoff and yet would not have a disproportionate cost. I mean obviously we could go through them specifically if you wanted, but I think in general terms, this is it. He needs virtual wars more than he can actually afford real ones.
This recalls a comment, an unforgettable comment Peter Pomerantsev once made on this podcast. Putin didn't want a war in Donbass. He wanted a movie about a war in Donbass, and he got the real thing at the end of the day. I wanted to shift a bit, unless, Andrew, did you have something you wanted to add there?
Well, yeah, putting the same thing slightly differently, if you look at how political technology has operated and developed over 20 years, I mean, nothing is ever completely virtual, but the faker, the more fake the target, the more made of paper the paper tiger is, then the easier it is to declare an apparent triumph. It's very easy to defeat fascism in Ukraine, for example, because there aren't many real fascists. But it's not that you run out of easy targets, it's that you're constantly shifting to targets where there are more real problems. So what you get is already a regular pattern of mess up and move on. Right? It's not that Russia has only lighted on the easy targets and not tried the difficult things. You know, it's toyed with some of the difficult things and made a god-awful mess in Donbass. And again, Turkey strikes me as an inappropriate target. There are real economic interests to harm. The whole thing is very hubristic. It involves making a god-awful mess and leaving all sorts of problems in your wake. Russia's been doing that for a long time.
Now, I wanted to...
But Russia can't really move on, though, can it? I mean, it's stuck in the Donbass. And so, in part, it went to Syria precisely to, particularly in international relations terms, pick up, you know, try and reclaim some of the ground lost from Donbass. But it didn't get out of the Donbass. And now it's in Syria, and frankly, it's stuck there. I mean, it's moved on in terms of its attention, but the point is it remains glued to these rather intractable conflicts.
Yeah, so you're not as involved as you want. You at one time might have been. You know, you leave behind people to sort of conduct a minimal clear-up operation, I guess.
I wanted to shift a little bit to Georgia, Moldova, and Ukraine, three other countries that were mentioned in this report. And as you noted, Andrew, these countries aren't just passive actors. They have agency. And is there anything they or what they can do, regardless of what Russia's doing or trying to do, to change the equation in their favor? I mean, it would seem to me that if they could get their acts together and reform, that this could really change the game, or perhaps not, if Russia's determined to intervene in them at all costs. What do you see there?
Well, firstly, it is worth looking at them as objects to some degree. I mean, they're Russia's favorite objects. They are nearby. Russia has genuine foreign policy reasons for seeking to dominate them. They are all relatively weak, so relatively easy to dominate. So they tend to be the favorite target for this type of thing, and will continue to be so. But in terms of subjects, in terms of their capacity to act as subjects, get their act together, I think what we're learning from Ukraine is how, you know, in the last 2 years, is how extraordinary resilient post-communism actually is. You know, it's been there for 20 years. It's developed very, very powerful mechanisms of reproduction and self-defense. And you're seeing how the reform efforts in Ukraine are being rebuffed and even attacked. Shooting the messenger is one of the favorite tactics of post-communism. Would-be reformists in Ukraine who are sort of targeting the corrupt, ending up getting charged with corruption themselves, that kind of thing. So I think the first thing for these three states is for them to be aware and for the whole world to be aware of the nature of the problem. Right? It won't work if, you know, two or three guys charge the castle on their own. It really does require concerted action with international support, and that action must target the kind of defense mechanisms and the kind of reproduction cycles that these systems have, particularly in the legal sphere, particularly in the media, particularly in terms of the interconnection of money and political influence. You know, attacking marginal sort of marginal points in the system doesn't work. You really have to attack everything at once, almost. But the good news is that there are some people in Ukraine committed to doing that. With international support, they can do more. But it's not a conventional task of reform where you sort of proceed from ticking one box to another. It has to be all out or it has to be nothing.
Mm. And in fairness, yesterday Ukraine did pass a landmark judicial reform that the West had been pushing for that I was frankly surprised passed. But I think your larger point is right, Andrew. Despite the massive social consensus and the broad nature of the Euromaidan revolution, you still have a post-communist system that has proven to be extremely resilient in that society. Mark, what are your thoughts on this? Go ahead, Andrew.
Yeah, or look at Moldova, where you have one guy whose public rating is 3%, but he basically has taken over the entire country,
right?
Because he controls all the key levers of power that protect post-communism. It's not because he's popular. It's not because people don't know that he's a crook simply lining his own pockets. All that's clear, but he controls all the levers that make the system work.
Mark, your thoughts?
Yeah, exactly, Andrew. Spot on about just how resilient, again, post-communism, we haven't really got a better term for it, really is. And therefore, I mean, it does create this extraordinary dilemma for the other states. On the one hand, absolutely reform, if successfully carried out, and isn't just simply a checkbox exercise, which is too often the case, and too often, I think, the way when foreign countries sought to assist and monitor the process, they tended to look at it in very sort of superficial terms rather than really looking at the sinews and levers of power. But so if you do manage to reform, then actually you do become much, much less vulnerable to Russian pressure and suasion and so forth, and actually probably also have a much better country that's much nicer to live in and much more economically and politically and socially dynamic. But of course, the Russians realize it. The road is a hard one. And therefore, it creates this dilemma for a country. Should it just simply lie low and try not to, as it were, attract Moscow's malign attention? Or should it embark upon a process that at the end means it may well hopefully be more independent of Moscow, but which will also probably attract Moscow's ire in at the same time?
In the medium
so again,
term, too.
Yeah, so I think this is why, again, we need to have, you know, as, and this is something that Andrew has noted, I mean, not only international support, which should also extend to the levels of certain forms of implicit or explicit guarantees. But also, it would make so much sense if these countries could actually play nice with each other. Now, I'm not talking about an Armenian-Azeri axis. I think that we are a long way to go before we reach that. But one of the striking things has been that, again, there's been a lot of talk about sort of cooperation and common perspectives between these various countries. In practice, everyone seems to, even when they do think of reform, everyone tends to think of it as a bilateral relationship between them and the West, rather than actually acknowledging that they do have actually quite a few common problems, both domestic and in the Kremlin, external.
Right. Now, there were attempts at this with Guam, for example, Georgia, Ukraine, Moldova, Azerbaijan, but it didn't seem to go anywhere.
There wasn't enough political capital domestically, or indeed in terms of international. It was one of these. I think that was much. Maybe I'm being far too cynical here, but I mean, I felt it was one of these. Again, we're much more into the box checking exercises. It was one of these things that everyone knew sounded good, but when it actually came to putting real resource and effort into it, and actually beginning to sort of prioritize the alliance rather than individual national interest, that's where it seemed to fall back.
And one of the things we're seeing now is the presence of Georgians in the Ukrainian government, and it's, you know, the highest profile of which is, of course, is Saakashvili, but he's by far not the only one. Do you see, maybe, Andrew, what do you think? Is this creating some connections that can lead to the kind of collaborative efforts that Mark's talking about?
Well, yeah, that was the example I was going to cite after Guam. I mean, it's success or failure. Hugely important, and it's interesting to see how many people want to see the Georgians fail. I mean, the Russians are constantly blackening Saakashvili's motives, and the kind of conservative forces within Ukraine are constantly complaining about non-nationals, you know, telling the Ukrainians what to do. Saakashvili, of course, we all know, isn't always his own best advocate, so he's the kind of third kind of force undermining its likely success. But, you know, he's also a ball of energy driving it forward. He's trying to launch a party at the moment. We'll see how broad it becomes, whether he attracts some Ukrainian reformers along with, you know, the kind of Georgian usual suspects. Mm. The start wasn't very good. One of the reform MPs, Sergei Leschenko, said, you know, why don't we have a Ukrainian in charge of all this? And Misha refused to step aside. So it's a good one to watch, because the stakes, you know, are quite high, because that kind of cooperation, whether it works or it doesn't, is very important.
Mark, I see you want to jump in here.
Well, the interesting thing is about this is not a Georgian state collaboration. In some ways, this is actually the Georgian Foreign Legion. people who, in some ways, are sort of dispossessed at home and have found another cause. And of course, it's exceedingly useful for them to be able to take their experiences, their positive and successful experiences, and hopefully begin to bring it to Ukraine. And obviously, the really important thing will be when it actually spreads beyond. It can't just simply be that Georgians fix Ukraine; it has to be Ukrainians who fix Ukraine. And you know, there is progress to be done. But again, the sad thing is that, as it were, these people are in Ukraine to an extent, because some of their progress, only some, in Georgia itself has been rolled back. At the point where we actually have governments assisting each other, that is a point I'll become a little bit more enthusiastic and optimistic.
Okay, before we move on to the next section, Andrew, I know you had some policy recommendations for the West in the short term here. You want to go through some of the main ones?
Well, as usual, no magic wand or silver bullet. But if you cast your mind back to this idea, whether you accept it or not, of medium-level conflict, then the West should do two things. You know, it should police the tripwires for conflict to get more dangerous or more intense. Russia is playing a very dangerous game already by pitching the level of conflict intensity that high. And there are all sorts of potential problems of misjudgment, mismanagement, or hubris. East Ukraine would be a classic example, you know, going too far. I would argue because the Russians actually don't understand the true nature of Ukraine, so they thought it would be a cakewalk, and it wasn't. So police the tripwires for conflict to get more intense and to set up incentives, you know, to, well, I almost use the word de-escalate then, which I've always hated, but, you know, to take the level of intensity down a bit. But also the other thing would be to look out for inflection points, you know, what can change trends that seem set. At the moment, Russia is playing nicey-nicey. Why? Because it sees a kind of coincidence of possibilities in the next 6 or 9 months that might lead to some softening of sanctions. So there are also, you know, Britain and Britain's vote, America's vote, even France's vote next year. Russia is sort of playing nice in the hope that the kind of external configuration changes in its favour. That's from Russia's point of view. But, you know, the West needs to look at the kind of inflection points that could change behaviours as well and try and encourage that when they happen.
Yeah. No, they're playing nice, but the conflict in Donbass seems to be escalating in recent weeks. But, I take your larger point. Mark, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, certainly there's no way I could or would want to sort of disagree with those. I mean, you know, policing the tripwires and all and so forth. I think the issue is, of course, though, that in the West, we haven't yet really come to terms with quite what it is that we want from this situation. First of all, is it just simply we want Russia to stop being beastly to its neighbours, which is a perfectly credible and creditable objective? Is it that we actively want to encourage the Eastern neighbourhood to reform and develop in certain ways? Or indeed, is it actually that when it comes down to it, we want Russia to be a different kind of state? And my concern is that these are all kind of lowest common denominator points. And that's not in any way to be critical of them. I mean, that's exactly where you start. But precisely, these are all really about trying to ensure that Moscow doesn't make things any worse, which is fine. But is that really, particularly when we're talking about sort of a 14-year span, the best that we should hope for? Or are we just simply awaiting the point when Putin dies or is toppled or, you know, explodes from Botox? And therefore, you know, we can think, well, maybe everything gets unlocked. I do feel that sort of underlying all these very useful sort of measures is actually that we need to have a much more sort of philosophical concept of what is it that we regard as being in our interests and also morally right to be doing in Russia's neighborhood.
I mean, isn't one of the problems that the West is essentially trying to defend the post-Cold War international order, and that's it? And Russia's trying to topple it. So the philosophically, you can't get much beyond that, no?
Well, I mean, even that, I'm uncertain. I mean, yes, in broad terms. Well, let me put it say, Russia is definitely trying to topple many of the pillars of that international order. Not honestly sure that they're necessarily all agreed on quite what it is they're after and which aspects of that order they most want to protect. Because after all, one of the most fundamental things is that surely countries should be allowed to do their own thing. And to put it bluntly, make their own mistakes if need be, but hopefully make their own triumphs. And at the moment, the best we seem to be hoping for is trying to ensure that people don't get lent on too much by Moscow, which is a pretty minimalist goal.
Mm. Now, on your three things, I would say we want all of the above. We want Russia to stop being beastly to its neighbors. We'd like to see its neighbors develop in a prosperous democratic direction. And we'd right like Russia to be a different kind of state. I think those three things are all interconnected.
But how far are they pious hopes rather than actual specific policy objectives to which we're willing to put resource?
Good point. Andrew, any last thoughts before we move on to the next segment?
Well, foreign policy isn't, you know, is always the art of the imperfect. You know, if we got all those three things right, you know, marvelous. A little bit of, well, we need more than significant progress, particularly with our relationship with the Eastern neighbourhood, given, as I said, the strength of existing regimes and their pathologies. But, you know, messy progress is fine. You know, that's often the law of the world.
Well, on that note, we'll shift gears in a few moments. We'll continue our discussion about Russia's conflict with Europe and where it may be headed. I'd like to remind you, you're listening to the Power Vertical podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRO. Joining me on the Skype line from London is Mark Galeotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russian security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us from London is Andrew Wilson, a senior policy fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and also author of the recently published book, Ukraine Crisis, What It Means for the West. I'd also like to remind you, you can subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you could follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical.
My prediction, then, is that the struggle against the European Union cannot end. If sanctions are ended tomorrow, I do not think they stop funding Marine Le Pen. If sanctions are ended tomorrow, I do not think they stop putting Farage on RT to talk about how the European Union is terrible. I think they don't stop inviting the Nazis of Europe to St. Petersburg for their annual conferences. I think if sanctions stop tomorrow, all that stuff continues, because the problem with Europe is fundamentally a domestic problem for Russia. The existence of Europe is a domestic problem for Russia, and where the ideology helps is it explains that that's normal. It's normal that your domestic problems are actually the fault of Europe. So the prediction would be that so long as Putin is in power, they're not going to stop trying to undo the European Union.
Well, that unmistakable voice, of course, belongs to the prominent Yale University historian Timothy Snyder. During a guest lecture at Brown University's Watson Institute of International and Public Affairs, the lecture was titled Ukraine and Russia in a Fracturing Europe, and Professor Snyder was responding to a question asking him to predict where things were going. Andrew, do you agree? Is Europe, the existence of a united Europe, a domestic problem for Russia? Because I believe what Professor Snyder was referring to here is that it is a alternative model of governance close to Russia's borders. It's a magnetic pull on Russia's former vassals in the former Soviet Union, and that Russia cannot help, this Russia cannot help but need to undermine it. Would you agree with that?
Yes, I would. Plus, Europe's way of doing politics, Europe's way of doing business, is pretty much antipathetic and even polar to Russia's way of doing politics and business. I think all the kind of hype about conservative values is probably the least important aspect of all that. But, you know, open democracies, real democracies, sovereign states voluntarily pooling their sovereignty for sort of postmodern reasons, all of that is kind of anathema to Russia's view of the world. Secondly, I don't think the lifting of sanctions would lead to any big change in Russia's behaviour for another reason, which is that they think Europe is falling apart. I think they genuinely believe that the kind of longer-term historical trend is in a direction that favours Russia. I mean, if you look at the things that they are doing and the things that they don't understand, they both point to that. The Russians were certain the Scots would vote to leave the United Kingdom in their independence referendum. They couldn't understand when that didn't happen. The Russians are probably pretty sure Le Pen has got a good chance of winning the French election next year. I don't think she does. It's too early, really, for Le Pen. There's still a kind of ceiling to her support. Nigel Farage isn't going to become an important cabinet politician in Britain anytime soon. But Russia thinks these people are the people of the next generation. They give it 5, 10 years, however long, then people like Le Pen will be the new mainstream, and all of that will be to their advantage. So very much so, yeah, this is a long-term... Russia sees this as a long-term trend and therefore has a long-term strategy for encouraging that trend.
So if we can play, you didn't address with this aspect in your report, but if you play the same game and project current trends to 2030, I mean, we can expect Russia for the foreseeable future to continue trying to undermine European unity?
Yeah, particularly because political technology, or whatever you want to call it, is good at tilting at windmills, but it's not particularly good at inventing things that never really existed at all. You know, it exaggerates small problems or enemies. So working with the grain works better. So it's important for Russia that Marine Le Pen already exists. It's important for Russia that Nigel Farage already exists. It's important that Alternative for Deutschland already exists, because Russia can then give them publicity. It can try and fund them if it can find a secret enough way of doing so.
Or in Marine Le Pen's case, not so secret.
Oh, yeah. the banking loan, sure. So Russia can encourage that with its resources if it's already there. Whereas more marginal groups, I think it would have trouble making much of.
Mark, your thoughts? I mean, first on the premise. Do you agree with Professor Snyder's premise that the mere existence of a united Europe is a domestic problem for Russia, and Russia is going to feel the need to always try to undermine it? And the secondly, is would you agree with Andrew's assessment of that?
Yeah, completely. I mean, I think the question about European values, more than anything else, European values are completely corrosive to a regime like Putin's, which is essentially kleptocratic and authoritarian, and in particular almost tries to ape some of the aspects of European political and social structures. Because when it comes down to it is this: Russians see themselves as European. The whole notion of Eurasianism and so forth has always been a sort of little kind of philosophical splinter perspective. In some ways, people trying to square the circle of being European and yet wanting to treat Europeanness as a buffet from which they can pick the bits that they like. But basically speaking, Russian culture has, and has been for centuries, one that regards itself as European and yet for various reasons always being held out of actually being part of the European mainstream where it deserves to be. From Mongol conquest onwards, that's always been the case. There's always been this yearning. So it's not just simply that you happen to have people on the other side of a border who have certain values which may well be attractive to a lot of people. It's the people, you know, the people who hold these values are the people whom you regard yourself as being part of. So in that respect, it's necessary for Putin to do two things. One, precisely to undermine the unity, the effectiveness of Europe. And of course, you know, just getting rid of sanctions, this is not a campaign that's purely because of sanctions, and therefore clearly also it wouldn't stop if sanctions were lifted. But at the same time, he has to undermine the notion of Europe, the idea of Europe. And this is, I think, why there's all this propaganda about gay Roper and the rise of neo-fascism, and why people like Marine Le Pen are actually doubly advantageous. So on the one hand, they are kind of handy, useful idiots, agents of influence, call them what you will, within the European Union, who are disruptive forces. But also, actually, you know, they are, frankly, neo-fascist in so many ways, and therefore you can actually use them to point to and say, look, European values, look at what kind of nasty people are arising there. So absolutely, from Putin's point of view, this is both a kind of a practical political issue, but also a desperate attempt to undermine the pull of Europe, which actually most Russians regard as being part of their birthright.
Mm. Now let's project this go ahead, Andrew.
It's interesting that Russia works best with the countries which have their own ambivalent attitude to Europe. Russia isn't going to shift the attitude of the Baltic states, for example. They're solid, bandwagoning with Europe as smaller states is the only kind of foreign policy state that strategy that makes any sense for them. Britain, you know, we have our post-imperial psychoses, you know, Russia can sort of pick away at those. Germany, Russia tries to encourage the revival of Sonderweg kind of thinking, you know, Germans' special place over and above outside normal Europe. And the way that Russia relates to France is particularly interesting. This kind of pitch that France and Russia are the kind of twin poles, guardians in some ways of European civilization. Again, over and above it, somehow better than it. So, as Mark was saying, very much a part of the European tradition. but very much pitching at the kind of bigger states with their own sort of post-imperial neuroses, which the EU project hasn't entirely buried.
Let's project this, because we're going to get some data points in the coming this month. We're going to get the first big one, but in the coming years, I mean, let's say Brexit, the Remain vote wins, entirely plausible. Let's say Le Pen does not win the presidency of France, very likely. Let's say Angela Merkel manages to stay in power in Germany, which is also likely. Let's say the migrant crisis gets under control, and let's say Europe kind of overcomes the funk it's in right now and gets back to more business as usual in a European sense. Will Russia continue to try to pick away at this, even though the trends may be reversing against it then? Andrew, why don't you jump on that first, I guess?
Well, just to pick the one that's most imminent and closest.
Brexit, you know, this
my
month.
Heart. Anyway, yeah. In nearly every possible post-referendum scenario, Russia still has strong cards to play. I mean, again, it's not creating or driving this process, but it can certainly exploit the kind of politics around it. The polls are very close. The one thing that isn't likely is a decisive victory for either side. Both a narrow win for yes and a narrow win for no, or remain and leave, would make the kind of post-referendum general EU politics pretty toxic. If Britain votes to leave, then I think the EU has a vested interest in making the subsequent negotiations as difficult as possible so that other states don't, you know, start to do the aren't tempted to do the same thing and renegotiate their relationship as well. Even a Remain vote doesn't solve the process. And we have this phrase in English anyway, a never-endum. There'll always be some side, you know, one side, you know, trying to keep the vote, campaigning for yet another vote time and time again. So even if the vote is narrowly to Remain, which is what the polls predict, 5 to 10%, 5 to 8% at best, that's not going to solve the problem.
Mm. Mark, would you agree? I mean, you've often said that Putin is like holding a mirror up to us and exploiting our weaknesses. And I just went through a kind of a series of things where weaknesses, if not eliminated, would be diminished.
Sure. But the point is that Russia's campaign is not because there are opportunities. The opportunities, as it were, shape Russia's campaign, and they make it easier. But the thing is, I mean, unless and until Europe becomes, shall we say, Russified, which is not going to happen, then Putin's regime has to continue to struggle against this. Because, anyway, this is the natural gravitational force is for Russia to become more European. And that's what most Russians, in my opinion at least, are not ardent militarists. They're not desperate to think of, I mean, obviously, on balance, would they like a great Russia compared to a not one? But what do they really want? They want a normal life. And they define a normal life as basically being a European life, not just in terms of material goodies, but also in terms of the freedoms and the securities that have. I mean, this is what basically Russians aspire to, just like Ukrainians aspire to and so forth. Just the Russians have had far, far fewer opportunities to express that. So in this respect, of course, regardless of what happens in Europe, Putin has to continue this campaign. He is holding back, and this is frankly a sort of emblematic of his entire philosophy, really, holding back the inevitable, trying to maintain Russia as a great power well beyond Russia's capacity or, you know, right to do so, trying to maintain Russia's separateness well beyond its real validity. I mean, this is basically Putinism writ large.
So it's almost like we're replaying the first principles of the Cold War in a very different way. I mean, either European values are going to overcome Putin's Russia and Russia's going to change, or, as you just said, the unlikely situation of which Europe will be Russified, or this uneasy tension is going to continue for decades and decades to come. No,
yeah. I mean, look, Well, I mean, although I don't like the idea of presenting this as a new Cold War, because I think
no, but I mean that's why I said the first principles of the
same way as a lot of historians, you know, when they try and look at things in this sort of the long durée, essentially see World Wars One and Two as being in a way part of one continuity. That World War One did not, as it were, solve the issue of a Germany that did not feel part of the world sort of unity. Well, so in some ways, I think actually one can talk about the first Cold War and then the Putin years as being part of the same thing. The end of the Cold War saw a partial Europeanization of Russia that was then hijacked. The forms of Europe, the consumer goodies of Europe, but actually with an authoritarian, very sort of non, shall we say, European or non-modern European regime in charge. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, in grand historical terms, that's the dynamic that's going on. This is a value-based struggle, for want of a better word. But the key difference between the Cold War is that in its own, I mean, often horrendous way, the Soviet Union did have an alternative value system, an active and positive value system that said these things are important and these things aren't, which increasingly became sort of, you know, clearly a sham. But nonetheless, it did exist, and there were people who genuinely believed it. There is no real value system to Putinism. There is a ramshackle hodgepodge of bits and pieces defined largely by opposition, but nothing really positive to offer.
Mm. Andrew, any last thoughts before we wrap it up for the week?
Yeah, I mean, I like the analogy. That's why Putinism is predicated on constantly raking over the remnants of the Cold War, its myths, even its ideological tropes to some extent, because it doesn't have an entirely fabricated ideology of its own to replace it with. So part of this kind of two-part struggle, just as World War One and World War Two were linked, in the 1930s, people obsessed over the, what actually happened in the First World War. And we are in a kind of similar position, obsessing over Russia in particular, mythologizing what happened in the Cold War period. So telling the truth about that and not letting Russian myths go uncontested, I think is a very important process, part of the process of getting this coda right.
Okay, on that, I can think of no better way to wrap it up. That's all we have time for today. I would like to remind you, you have been listening to the Power Vertical Podcast. My name is Brian Whitmore, author of the Power Vertical blog here at RFRL. Joining me on the Skype line from London has been co-host Mark Galliotti, a professor at New York University, an expert in Russia's security services, and author of the blog In Moscow Shadows. Also joining us from London has been Andrew Wilson, a senior policy fellow at the European Council on Foreign Relations, and author of the recently published book, The Ukraine Crisis, What It Means for the West. Thank you, gentlemen, for an enlightening discussion.
Thank you.
It was a pleasure.
And I'd also like to thank our brilliant, patient, and ridiculously overworked producer, Tanya Koncheva, and my indispensable and totally awesome colleague, Pavel Butorin, managing editor of RFRL's Russian language television program, Current Time, which you can watch at www.currenttime.tv. You can also follow Pavel on the Twitter at Pasha Butorin. I'd also like to remind you, you could subscribe to the Power Vertical podcast on iTunes. You could read the Power Vertical blog and watch the Daily Vertical at rfrl.org. And you can follow us on the Twitter at Power Vertical. The Power Vertical podcast and all Power Vertical products will take a break next week. We resume our regular schedule on June 13th, and the next podcast will be on Friday, June 17th. So until then, I leave you with the ambient sounds of my favorite socially conscious Russian rapper, Noise MC.